Hello there! This is the AIPT Comics Podcast. My name is David Brook, your co-host, and this is episode 33. We're in August right now. That means July sales are out, and comic book news is up. With me is Forrest Hollingsworth, my best co-host ever.
Hello! I am Forrest with two R's, and I don't know what the internet is.
I swear to God you said that one like 4 months ago.
I swear to God. No?
We're going to get the archivist for this podcast.
Back.
Yep, we're going to get him out here. Jimmy?
Get him out here, people.
Jimmy? Check it. Check the tape. This is the comic book podcast for AIPTcomics.com, where we talk about the latest comic book news. We talk about the best books of last week. We give you a little primer on what's coming in the next week. And also, we have some fun segments as well. This month, it's the big sales episode where we're going to be talking about July 2019 sales. So we're excited about that. And we're excited about talking about what is, you know, breaking the bank, so to speak. For all the publishers out there. Before we get there, we're going to talk about the latest news. And it is very DC-centric this week. We promise we didn't do that on purpose. This is just how the news happens sometimes.
Oops, all DC.
At the top of the news, Jim Lee came out and said that DC digital sales are plateauing, in quotation marks. I don't know if he actually did the air quotes or not. And disheartening. Again, I don't know if he had the quotation marks, but in this news from Newsarama, they had the quotation marks. It's not too surprising that he said this. I think it's been pretty flat for digital sales for a while. But as, you know, what is he? He's the co-publisher and chief creative officer at DC Comics. It's a little disheartening when someone at that level is saying this.
I like how I think he's probably not realizing how it's disheartening for him to say it's disheartening. But I do love how his title and Dan Didio's are basically a sentence. I just wanted to get that in there first.
You think they could just narrow it down, you know? But no.
Yeah.
But
boss.
Yeah. He talked a little bit about DC Universe and the subscription-based model of that. But again, he was down on that too. And he was actually saying that these subscription services are putting a downward pressure on transactional sales. Interesting wording there, transactional sales.
Yeah, that's interesting. I would assume that he's trying to be positive about DC Universe in general.
Right.
He said that it's thriving, but that the individual sales are not doing well. So what he's saying by transactional sales is he means someone that doesn't have a subscription-based model buying an individual digital comic through DC's storefront, or maybe even Comixology, I'm not sure, is down as compared to the number of subscribers that they have who obviously have access to their DC Universe catalog of books, the same way that Comixology has unlimited or Marvel has unlimited. And the way that he's phrasing it is very interesting to me. And we're pulling this from Newsarama, a really great article on Newsarama, but he also had an interview directly with ICV2. And he said, the fact that it is kind of plateaued and we hit a wall speaks to a lot of different things. We need to reinvent what we're doing digitally. The subscription service that we're offering on the DC Universe platform is part of that. We just have to get better at marketing to people that know our characters, love our characters, but aren't buying comics. That's really interesting to me, and I think it speaks to a lot of what we're seeing outside of what DC is saying publicly, which is, you know, HBO funding the second season of Doom Patrol.
Right, right.
They're reshuffling all sorts of lines into these, we'll see if they're successful, age brackets. They're closing smaller imprints and stuff. It makes me think that, well, a lot of people had kind of red alarms about this and stuff, that his primary concern, and maybe even Dan Didio's primary concern, we also can't ever discredit that Warner Media is a huge part of this, so maybe the three groups together, are trying to make DC Comics in general less confusing.
Right. Oh, that's obvious when they've reduced all the pop-up, or what are they called?
Right.
Lines?
The imprints.
Imprints. Yeah. There you go, DC Kids. Ooh, so hot.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they just hired Mary Javins to DC's executive editor of new publishing initiatives. And I think this goes hand in hand because she is being tasked with the initiative will include a renewed focus on DC's international efforts. That's fascinating to me. Does that mean they're pulling in international creators? No, it probably means they're trying to push comics in international markets.
It may be both. I kind of read this a little bit as like a Karen Berger type position.
Right.
Where she's being tasked specifically with finding and promoting comics which will do well in an international market. Whether or not that means marketing books that already exist.
Right.
Or if it means developing an entirely new line or set of books, I'm not really sure. And I would assume that they're giving her the leeway to figure that out.
It's definitely the corporate aspect has definitely come down hard. And I think it all started last summer when they got the new president. I forget her last name, but Pam. And ever since then, like, you know, there's been all this speculation. Dan Didio and Jim Lee have come out multiple times, like, trying to, you know, calm people down. There's definitely some kind of unrest going on, I think, at the publisher. And obviously, it could be good in the long run. But at this time, it still feels like they're trying to get their legs under
them.
Yeah,
it's hard. I think it's admittedly hard to have faith in it.
Right, that's true.
When the hump to get over is that they have to cancel and restructure a lot of books.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And fans don't like that. The fans that are already bought in don't like that. I think it just – all of these moves together – make it exceedingly clear that their concern is less existing fans and more capturing
that's true.
New fans.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of like – that's like a very corporate way of looking at it, isn't it? I mean, it's all about increasing sales, getting that stock up.
Right. And they're operating under the assumption that anyone that's already reading is bought in.
Yeah, and that's not necessarily the case. You're going to lose people if you just start cutting Doom Patrol or other titles that people love. You know, just to speak to Mary Javins for a second, when I was in Europe on vacation a couple months ago, it was kind of fascinating to see how these, not just DC, but Image and Marvel as well, how they package these books and how, like, Doomsday Clock, over in Vienna, you don't get each issue. You get a packaged 3 or 4 issue pack of Doomsday Clock or other titles, probably because the translation process is, you know, takes time, and by the time that they're done, you might as well just package it together. But that's almost like lost sales in my mind, if you're putting out these mini graphic novels. And I wonder if that's part of her job to somehow figure out how to, you know, sell. Or maybe that's how they sell to Europeans, because they don't want to read single issue 20 page books. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I would assume it's her job to figure it out.
Right.
Yeah. They may be looking at renegotiating distribution lines and all that stuff, and I don't know if that goes through Diamond at all, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question.
I don't have a very good perspective on the international market, aside from how fascinated I was that by the stuff you were dispatching when you were in Europe, as you said.
Yeah. I don't know. They're quoting me, but and you translate it makes no sense to what I said.
Right. That's weird.
So in other news, Dan Didio, also at DC, what was his title? Co-publisher?
Yeah, he's just co-publisher.
Yeah. His isn't a sentence.
His is two words.
He's concerned, quotes, I don't know if you did quotes or not, about nostalgia, quotes, driving the comic book market. This is, again, the title at the Newsarama news for this. He's concerned about nostalgia driving the comic book market. That's kind of fascinating to me. There's an over-reliance of nostalgia. Now, this is so weird to me that he's saying this when, like, movies and reboots. I mean, nostalgia is such a big part of sales across multiple media formats that... why would he be saying this?
Here's the thing that fascinates me about it, which is the doublespeak. He's got, where my concern comes from, as you said, is over-reliance on nostalgia, speculator marketing, variant covers, and a lot of things that seem to be driving numbers and sales to give the appearance of a healthy industry. But it's not built on the ongoing success of the individual titles in order to keep those numbers successful and maintained. If we're creating these artificial highs on a continual basis, if something pulls apart, that does it. It breaks the infrastructure overall, and now we have to change how buying these patterns in that fashion to build something that is a more healthy business. That's a very good overview. That's very sound.
Yeah.
I think he's touching on a lot of frustrations that readers, reviewers, marketers, fans that aren't bought in yet, as Jim Lee is trying to target, have those legitimate frustrations, right?
Right.
There's 23 covers to Absolute Carnage.
Right.
That's crazy.
Right.
But then he says,
oh boy.
Our choice right now is to go through primarily reprinted material because we feel that the nostalgic material is really what people have been enjoying most. And we want to go back with that again.
Yeah.
This is specifically about what they're doing with Mad Magazine.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But there will still be a smattering of original material in several of the books going forward. We have a plan that pushes out for the next year, and we'll be reviewing how this strategy has worked over the next year to see whether or not we'll continue on moving past that. Right now, we're still publishing. We'll still have new material. We'll still have Mad 20. We'll have other things that people can look forward to in Mad. Okay, cool. That's fine. I think he's going to miss Mad. I think a lot of people are. You just said the exact opposite thing of what you were saying.
So here's the here's the difference, though. Can I jump in?
Yeah, go for it.
I feel like the first part, he's saying a lot of the sales are driven up by variant covers and all these special covers. And And it's like, it's a market that is very, it's almost like winning the lottery. It's like you get the three cherries, you get a little money, but it's not sustainable. It's not going to, that person who buys all 20 Absolute Carnage covers isn't coming back every month. They're not going to be buying 20 variant covers next month because there may not be 20 variant covers. Whereas the second part, he's saying we're repackaging old stuff because, yeah, I don't know how it's much different. It is similar.
It's not,
but
I don't think it's different at all. I think you just talked yourself into realizing
I did,
that it's
I
not
did
different at all.
On a level, but yeah. I do think it's a little more sustainable because you're putting a repackaged product on the shelf that isn't necessarily pumping up the sales just for a flash in the pan, because that book can sit on the shelf for a lot longer.
Mad.
Yeah. When they repackage it. Although, you know, what really worries me is the way he described this repackaging of Mad. Could you imagine in a future where they repackage Action Comics, where they repackage Dan Jurgens, you know, two or three of his runs, and then they have Bendis write an opening six-page story, but then they just only do that from in the future? Like, could you imagine that, where, like, serial storytelling's dead and they just repackage old graphic novels and put in a little bit of new stuff? If that succeeds, that model with Mad, I would not be surprised if DC goes ahead and does that with something else like Batman.
Absolutely. I think that's the exact problem with what he's saying.
And that's frightening.
Is that he has such a good overview of the problems that publishers, retailers, and fans have.
Mm-hmm.
And then later in the same interview, he's blatantly ignoring that he has that information.
Right.
It seems untenable to me, at the very least. And it does make me worried about that kind of repackaging and weird nostalgia marketing and stuff. I don't want that.
Yeah, and it's, I don't know, it's really weird. I mean, how do movies figure it out? I guess it's because their product is a lot easier to market across the world, right? Because you've got this infrastructure of cinemas and DVDs, sure, and Amazon selling DVDs.
Yeah,
that for decades they had video stores, and whereas comics, they just have the video store model, right? They only have, you go to a shop, mm-hmm, and you buy it. I mean, they're dabbling with digital, but it's not working
well. Yeah, and I think what they're finding is that their current digital model was to just emulate the in-store experience, and that they're finding that a lot of readers don't want that.
I don't know.
It's very, very interesting to me overall that Jim Lee and Didio both seem to understand what the problems are.
Right.
But I don't know that they've identified solutions. I don't know that I have, to be fair.
I mean,
either.
Yeah, of course.
But I like seeing moves like Maria Javins getting moved. And stuff like that, because it does seem like they're trying.
Right, yeah, they're not just keeping the status quo when it comes to their editors and whatnot.
Right.
In other news, non-DC related, exciting. publisher Edelweiss has listed a collection of Super Rare X-Men comics, and it's coming out October 2020. It's called Adventures of the X-Men Tooth and Claw. Ooh, this isn't the first time that they've supposedly like leaked this information, and it hasn't come true.
Yeah, Edelweiss.
Yes.
Posts a lot of listings.
Uh-huh.
They also posted a listing for a Venom and Spider-Man body swap story,
uh-huh,
written by Mariko Tamaki, and I haven't heard anything about that. It's just listed for 2020, so I don't know if that's real or not.
They realized it should be the plot to the movie Venom 2, so, you know.
Venom,
Eminem, if you're listening.
Yeah, but they, otherwise, so to just clarify, we're not sure that this information is accurate,
right?
Especially because Marvel hasn't confirmed it.
Correct.
But they say that on February 18th, 2020, they will be releasing a 128-page collection titled Adventures of the X-Men tooth and claw.
I just said that, man.
Did you?
Yeah, that's okay. Go ahead. Huh. I'm just kidding.
And it's going to be collecting a bunch of X-Men backup stories from Spider-Man magazine.
Ooh.
That debuted from 1994 to 1997. They were launched as a tie-in to the 1994 Spider-Man cartoon, the magazines were.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a Spider-Man story on one side and then an X-Men story on the other. So kind of like what they're doing with Marvel Team Up right now.
Yeah.
Or 2-in-1. Like, you can flip it and read the other story.
Love those.
It was Spider-Man on one side and X-Men on the other. These stories have not been collected anywhere else.
Ever.
This is it. They're not even included in that giant Children of the Atom book or box that's coming out.
It must be a licensing issue, right?
Maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. I think generally these kind of weird gimmicky books, they don't tend to reprint or repackage.
Yeah.
Like, I haven't ever seen the Pizza Hut or Taco Bell books in anything.
One might argue it's a nostalgia buy.
It is. I think that it is. This seems a little different to me, though. And I was actually just going to say that I think this is the kind of nostalgia buy that I want.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't readily accessible. It's not on Marvel Unlimited. It's nowhere. And they're finding a way to get it to consumers that either read it and have never been able to find it again.
Yeah.
Or never read it and have kind of heard about it. I mean, some of these stories, I don't know that I've heard of Tooth and Claw in particular.
Yeah.
But some of these stories have, like, a legendary status in the community. I think folks are going to read them and find that they're not as good as they maybe hope that they are. But the same way, in the same sense that video game publisher Devolver Digital brought over a game called Metal Wolf Chaos from Japan earlier this month,
mm-hmm.
that game had been built up to this kind of, like, legendary status in the community because it never got out of Japan. And I think that these comics will serve a very similar purpose. And I think that that's a much better nostalgia capitalization than what Mad Magazine is doing, for example.
I really wish when they did these reprints, they included the ads. Because those ads, man, if you ever pulled an old comic from your long box, holy crap, these ads are crazy. They really bring you back.
Yeah. I love seeing graded copies of, like, Spider-Man books. And the whole back cover is like a Zit medication ad. Like, oh, yeah, cool.
Or like the Sega Saturn.
The first Todd McFarlane.
Like video game consoles that never existed past like the release.
Yeah. So it's interesting. I hope that it comes out. I don't know that it will. Maybe even just getting this news generated will push Marvel to publish something like this or find something like this while they're still trying to capitalize on their 80 gear.
We want the Twinkie comics. Print them. Reprint them.
I want them. I want them. I need them. I want an entire food license package.
Ooh, yes.
I want Pizza Hut,
600
Taco
pages,
Bell,
or
Twinkie.
We Riot.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, there's probably something like that out there. I don't remember if there was. I know the Ninja Turtles had their own, like...
I fucking hope so. That would be awesome.
The Ninja Turtles had these, like, pies that had green ooze in them. Oh, my God. I love those. So good. In other news, Chris Hassan is reporting at Terrificon, and he's going to be talking with Todd Knock. Well, he already did talk with Greg Hildebrandt, Bob Cloud, Chris Claremont, Steve Orlando, Tom King, Mark Bagley. Oh my God, he's talking to everybody, and it's going to be on X-Men Monday on Monday tomorrow. Check that out. I don't know what he's asking them. Hopefully pertinent questions. I'm sure he's trying to get their take on Dawn of X and what Jonathan Hickman's doing, because we're all enraptured by what he's doing right now. Are we not, Forrest?
That's it. I don't know how to respond to a double negative. Yes, no. I like book.
Speaking of House of X and what Jonathan Hickman's doing, over here at AIPTComics.com, if you come every Friday, we have a new column called Fantastic Five. J.G. Travers is putting this together for us, and he's collecting the top five highest reviews at AIPTComics.com. So if you didn't come on Wednesday and read all our reviews, and didn't come on Thursday because you missed Wednesday to read all our reviews, come on Friday, and you can start here and see the top books that we loved across the team. It's not just one person. You were in there this week with Absolute Carnage number one.
Yes, I gave Absolute Carnage number one a 10 out of 10.
Get out.
Which we will speak about later.
Ooh, spoilers. Green Lantern number 10 was on there from Ritesh Babu. He also gave his book a 10. Berserker Unbound number one from JJ got a 10 out of 10. And that's from Jeff Lemire and Mike Diodato. And that is a Dark Horse book. I haven't read that one yet. I need to do that.
I checked it out.
Ooh. Is it good?
It's not a 10 out of 10. shots fired at JJ.
Ooh.
No, I think it's very good. It's very interesting. It has a ways to go. The art is amazing.
That guy's a master. Nathan Simmons gave Snowglass Apples a 10 out of 10 as well. God, we give so many 10s. I promise you, we don't give this many 10s usually. And I
we
gave.
We don't. This is a very good week.
It is. Comics. It is actually. And Snowglass Apples, to be clear, is actually a hardcover collection. So it's a little different. And then I also gave House of X number 2 a 10 out of 10. And I'm also in that column, which I'll talk about later too. Spoilers. So. Let's get into the spoilers then, because in our next segment, top books of last week, we talk about our two favorite books that came out last week, and we always start this segment with the Comic Book Roundup's top critic and top fan reviewed books on comicbookroundup.com, and this week, the fan favorite with a 9.5 was House of X number 2, no surprise.
61 reviews, though.
Damn. Do you have any enlightening reviews to impart with us?
I can tell you what the people are saying.
Tell us what they're slinging.
Give me just a second here. I'll tell you what the folks are saying about the comics.
Now, these people...
The comics that you can see on the Comic Roundup.
They didn't write this in the newspaper. Oh, no. This was on the intranets.
Correct.
Something that Forrest knows nothing about.
Since I have pulled those numbers,
yes,
we've actually gone up to 63 reviews.
Oh, my God. Put it on the big board. Put it on the big board. Ding, ding, ding.
The top number 10 review with 8 likes on comicbookroundup.com comes to us from the Comic Cookbook. I am speechless. My excitement for Hickman on X-Men has doubled since the previous issues. It's a joy to see Pepe Larraz on his A-game, which is especially impressive considering the bi-weekly schedule for both him and Silva. I'm not going to spoil or say anything else. Just read it.
For a guy who's speechless, he sure had a lot of words in there, I'm going to say. All right.
Called out. I also like this.
No! There's no more, Forrest. We're done.
Hold on. Dennis G.
Oh my
Morales.
God.
Only
We're
has
out
a
of time,
word.
Forrest. Sorry.
He's
the show's over.
He's only got a 2-word review. Dennis deserves to be heard.
What did he say?
He said, holy shit.
Wow. That could be negative for all we know. We don't know how he meant that.
It was a 10 out of 10.
So. maybe he had a heart attack because it was so bad, and then his finger slipped and he gave it a... He went to put 0-1 instead of 1-0. Yeah, I could see how that could happen.
Yeah, of course.
The top critic rated books were Harley Quinn number 64 with a 9.4. And is it still House of X number 2 with a 9.4?
Yes, sir.
Wow. Our very own Christopher Showalter gave Harley Quinn a 9.5 out of 10. I was looking at his review earlier today. He really likes it. I believe that book's about comic book crossovers, or at least lampooning them, which is pretty cool.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
He looks like he said in his summary, hilarious and meaningful, Harley Quinn number 64 serves as an excellent commentary on crossover events.
Excellent. You know, I have to say, Sam Humphries, I reviewed one or two when he jumped on, and I just love his tone on the book. It's very suiting to the character, and it's a lot of fun. So there, I said it.
You can't take it back.
Now it's your turn to say it. For what is your number 2 most favorite book of last week?
Okay, so I'm going to be totally transparent.
Oh my God, there's
started.
A footnote. Go ahead.
My number 2 would have been House of X number 2.
Wow.
And it still is.
Okay.
In the same sense that the critics have rated Harley Quinn and House of X as a 9.4, I am rating this other book alongside House of X. I just felt that we couldn't talk about House of X for that long.
It's keeping us on the edge of our seats. Wait, you should You should talk about the book, why it's good, and then reveal the title at the end and see if people can guess.
You think so?
I don't know. Would that be fun? It might be fun.
Yeah. Oh man, I think people are gonna get it right away.
That's true. That's true.
So
nothing else like this book on the stands. Oh my God.
Yet. Till October.
Yeah.
My number 2 pick this week is Deceased number 4, written by Tom Taylor with art by Trevor Harrison. I am astounded by how good of an event this is, and I have been continually across 4 issues so far. It's really like thoughtful and provocative and almost poetic in a sense that I didn't think a lot of event comics could be, especially ones about zombies. This issue is predicated on a really, really big spoiler that I don't want to give away. It's bookended by those moments about kind of an atomic threat to the world. And the way that it is nailed home throughout the narration, throughout the issue, is really, really impressive. But I also think that this book does a really good job of living in its smaller moments. Green Arrow puts his hand on Clark Kent's chest to try and stop him. He's like, "You can't do that." And then he goes, "I also realize that this is a symbolic gesture and that you could walk through me if you wanted to."
Nice.
And I just feel like Taylor has really thought at length about what these characters would do in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, on both sides, the humorous and the sad, I think that there's a good balance walked between them. And I think Trevor's art does a really, really good job of kind of portraying the overwhelming, encroaching darkness that all of them are seeing both the best and worst of themselves in. It's just very, very well done. And I think that's predicated on the fact that it's an event book about small character moments.
Mm, nice. It's pretty cool. I love the title. I just can't get over the title.
It's
so perfect.
Yeah.
Well, my number two book, I'm not going to tell you the title. No, I am. It's called Sea of Stars number two. And we actually had Dennis Hopeless Hallam on the other day on this very show. And he talked a little bit about it. He's co-writing with Jason Aaron. And it's drawn by Stephen Green with colors by Rico Renzi. I was not super duper into the first issue. I still liked it. The second issue does a really good job fleshing out the backstory of the father-son duo that are the main characters in this book. There are also some incredible creature designs by Stephen Green. I talk about this in more detail in my comic book review, which is on AIPTcomics.com. I recommend reading that if you want to get my like full take. But I have to say, this book is panning out to be quite an interesting juxtaposition. We've got the father and the son split up. The father is nearly dying at every moment. He's got threats. He's running out of oxygen, et cetera, et cetera. Meanwhile, his son is zipping around space like some kind of superhero when he's really just a human. Something happened to him. We don't know what yet. And he seems to be peachy. Whereas there are threats looming, the father is directly being, you know, there are aliens trying to eat him.
Right, right.
So it's kind of an interesting balance between the two. And I'm sure they'll come together and something will happen that will change their predicament on both sides. But yeah, I'm really excited for this book and seeing where it goes. It's like a space opera, but honed down to a father-son relationship. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's honed down to a really fine emotional point.
Yes.
And I thought that this issue highlighted the writing approach that Dennis said he and Jason are taking.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Really, really well, which is like, you can tell that there's individual moments or aspects or character beats that each of them has thought about. I think Dennis said that he's writing the father's story.
Yep.
And Jason is writing the kid's story.
Yep.
And you can see their voices in those separate tracks. Which I think also makes it really exciting to know that at some point their voices are going to come together,
mm-hmm.
and that they know the plot beats and the emphasis and thematics that each of them is delving into. And when they have to meet out how those things blend together, I think that that's going to be really great and very, very interesting.
I feel like I want to say the words "meet out" when I make a charcuterie sometime in the future, but I have to. I'm trying to work on it. Like, how will I say that? Like, the meat's out, but not like, no, that's too direct. What is your favorite book of last week?
My favorite book from last week is Absolute Carnage number one, written by Donnie Cates with primary art by Ryan Stegman. I've already written a review of this book, so I'm just going to read you my paragraph from Fantastic Five.
He's going to read the entire review.
No, it was like 1,300 words. I am going to read a chunk from this article that is on AAPTcomics.com.
Oh, all right.
Which says, "It's not just Peter Parker and Eddie Brock that have worn and bonded with these strange alien creatures. It's Wolverine, Captain America, The Thing, Mania, Ghost Rider, Scream, and countless others. God, Carnage or Null, is coming for them all. Eddie just happens to be the only one that can see it for all the literal and abject horror that it is. This kind of overarching picture and structure for an event feels not only refreshing and exciting in the micro, but also like an overall rehaul of Venom's thematic elements into a more appropriate story, straight up and down sci-fi horror storytelling. Like they always should, can, and will be from now on. Do you need to know what happens in Doverton or who Lee Price is or what in Symbiote is to get it? Yeah. But this issue also feels well-crafted enough to stand on its own for new and old readers, even really old readers like myself who started with Lethal Protector, to embrace it wholeheartedly.
Nice.
I thought it was very, very singularly fantastic and a really great new paradigm for event storytelling on Marvel's side after a year of tedious events.
I can't believe what Stegman's producing. Like, how is he...
It's one of the most exquisitely produced and refined artistic first issues I've ever seen.
I swear to God, I'm not knocking him. I feel like he went from he was going 70 miles an hour, and now he's going like 120. And I don't know if it's because he just has more time to put into each issue, or
they did say in an interview or the director's cut, I think, that this first issue took 6 months to put together.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can see that.
Interesting. Yeah. I really like the issue too.
There's a really fantastic segment. I'm wondering if you got as much out of it as me, where Eddie and Peter are at the end of like a prison hallway.
Yeah.
It's all dark, and then there's like these red sirens and lights going off. The classic Carnage red blood kind of thematic element. And then Carnage is just walking down this prison hallway towards them with a big hole in his chest, reaching into this hole in his chest and pulling out like symbiotic worms.
Yeah. That was
that
good.
Are infecting all of the prisoners. It's just this like slow build of very, very gory horror.
Body horror.
That you like never see. Yeah, body horror for sure.
Yeah.
That you like never see in Marvel books. And I think that simultaneously I was like, yes, that's Carnage. And also, holy shit, this isn't Marvel.
That's interesting.
You know, like, it was so well done that I got pulled so immediately into the story, and I was so impacted by the intentionality of that scene in particular.
Yeah.
That I was thinking of it as that world, not like, oh, I'm reading a Marvel comic, which as a reviewer and as a podcast host, I tend to get a bit of a screen door effect where I can still see the comic for what it is,
mm-hmm.
or who the creators are or who the editor is. But this issue really pulled me into the story in a way that I don't think anything has since Saga.
Saga from Image Comics?
Yes.
Gotcha. I didn't love it as much as you did, but I still appreciate how intense the horror and the art is and you know, how it's all coming together. The one thing I'm wondering about is Cletus's character. He seems to just be that, you know, Jason type villain right now who's always chasing him, which is probably the point. But I'm very curious about the character, and it's his perspective feels a bit flat to me right now. But maybe that's not the intention of it anyway.
You know, I don't think that it is. I think that the interesting thing is that Knowles' character is actually more nuanced and interesting and in-depth than Cletus's is.
That's true.
But Eddie and Peter, the central other, the hero figures in this book, are so like defined by their personal problems.
Yeah.
And their personal character flaws and traits and stuff.
I loved it when Peter called him out for not admitting to being the father. Because you know that's where that's coming from,
right?
For Peter.
Yeah. 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 But then to be thrown up against this force that doesn't care about that at all, right?
Right?
As much as the readers and the writers do, to have a force that is just like, I don't care, I'm going to kill you.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of the scariness and the horror that these stories need at times.
True. Yep. Comes at a good time, too, because it's about to be Halloween.
Hell yeah.
Pumpkin spice, baby. Anyway... moving on,
the official drink of Absolute Carnage fans.
Oh my god, they should make they have to have a pumpkin spice knock in there somewhere. One of the tie-ins at least. My favorite book this week was House of X number 2, which was probably a lot of people's favorite books. It astounded me when I read it. I wasn't a super big fan of Power of 10, number one. So I was like already kind of like on a lower level of like, okay, let's see what this is. And I was blown away by it. And I knew I was going to be writing a review for it. So I was probably a little more critical of it while I was reading it, or I was trying to be. And it just blew me away because it's, I feel like it stands alone as its own story. You don't need to read the other issues to necessarily get it or respect what it's doing, because it's all about one character. I don't want to spoil anything in it because a big part of it is like...
I don't think we can.
I mean, it kind of is revealed on the very second page, but it's the way Hickman and Larraz pull you into the story and tell it. The pacing of this book is so perfect. And I just feel like it's an example of where the creators have control over the reader. And if it was a movie, have a control over the viewer, in that you are on the edge of your seat and you are like literally waiting for every element to come, because the book builds on itself. It not only builds on the other issues that came before, but it builds on itself. And as it pushes forward, it gets your imagination going. It gets you excited for what's happening and what it could mean. So by the end of the issue, you're like literally like, I either have to read it again or you have to take a break, because it's that intense, I felt. And
yeah, I agree.
It's just intensely absorbing, the story. And it's kind of a spoiler to say this, but it's kind of like Groundhog Day. Although in my review, I said it's Groundhog Life.
Yeah.
I'll say no more about that. But I'm really excited for what this means for X-Men going forward, too. It's like a mission statement, this issue. And the Marvel marketing around it, around this new push from Hickman, revolved around what we learn in this issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you can kind of, through the other covers that are out, House of X and Powers of 10, you can kind of chart where they're going from here.
Right.
And it is very much the direction that I want them to take.
Nice.
I think also, like, the art is amazing. Pepe Larraz is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
I also think it's a really good idea to have the same colorist on both books.
Yeah, Marte Gracia. Yep.
Yeah. A fantastic colorist.
For sure. Yeah. There's a lot of nuance in the art that I talked a little bit about one of the characters' shirts that they wear. And then just like, I don't know. This is some of the best comics that I think they've ever come out. And I'm not just saying that because I'm excited for it.
Right. I am very excited for it. And I'm very excited by it because I agree that it is some of the best. The tone and the intentionality with which the story is told, I get the impression that Hickman has been thinking about this particular beat longer than anything else. And the way that it is executed is so amazing. There are no gaps. There's nothing like, oh, the writer thinks you would get that, or like it's subtext, or like you really have to know who this person is that's writing this story to get it.
Yeah.
You can read this issue and be completely and totally absorbed by it and get what it means for the X-Men retroactively and going into the future. I think Hickman perfectly nailed the message that he wanted to write into it.
I was thinking this the other day. Could you imagine if Marvel or DC or Image or whoever, they had a line of comics and they gave creators a full pass to do whatever they wanted with a book, and they did this level of revolutionizing it and like pushing it in a new direction? Like, I'm trying to think, like, what would be the Spider-Manization of, you know, Powers of 10 and House
sure.
of X?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think a little bit that's what the Ultimate Universe was.
Ooh. Interesting.
But I don't think that it was as well received as this.
It wasn't as concise either.
Right. I think that this is executed really well because we have one person telling the story.
Yeah.
Ultimate got too big. Honestly, Elseworlds gets too big.
Mm-hmm.
They struggle with that. And that's not to say I don't want creators to have work. It's just that...
Stop. It's over.
You need...
Don't go so big.
People are nostalgic for those really long runs of Eric Larson on Spider-Man.
Right.
Or something. And the big two aren't doing that anymore. But to see why people enjoyed those books and those runs so, so much in real time, like we are with House of X and Powers of Ten.
Mm-hmm.
It makes me nostalgic for it.
Yeah, definitely. I am very excited to see where we get to by the end of this. So in the midway point, Forrest and I have agreed when we reach House of X number 3 and Powers of Ten number 3, we're going to be talking about the series, the halfway point, and what this means possibly for X-Men in a future episode.
Yes.
But in our next segment, we're going to be talking about the sales, comic book sales for July 2019. And what do you know? House of X and Powers of Ten are a big factor in the sales. Overall, sales are up 1%, according to Comicron. This is the resource we're using for this. It's up 1%, which isn't a lot, but I mean, we're up to $298 million for the industry.
For the year.
Yes, yeah. up to date, yeah. And then we're 7% higher for July, which is, that's actually a little significant, I'd say.
Yeah, I think, yeah, that's approaching double digits.
Just to give you a broader stroke, Marvel is still leading the pack. Their dollar share is 41%. That's so big. DC is only getting 26, a quarter of the market. Like, I can't imagine that's making anyone at Warner happy.
No, I don't think that it is. They're like, you can see Jim Lee and Dan Didio grasping at straws, right?
Could you imagine, like, the president, or I don't know who they are, the CEO of the company is like, they call it Big Two. But the numbers show something different.
A much more fragmented market than that.
The next publishers are Image with 8%, IDW with 4%, Dark Horse with 3%. I'm surprised Dark Horse is so low. Dynamite at 2%, Boom at 2%, Viz at 1.5%, and then Titan with 0.7%. Interesting. Are there any things that pop out at you about these numbers?
One interesting stat that I personally wouldn't have realized but was on Comic-Con is that this is the first time that the X-Men comics, House of X number 1 and Powers of 10 number 1, are the first and second top-selling books for the month. And this is the first time that the X comics have done that since 2001.
That's crazy.
Which would have been the year after the first X-Men movie came out, and it would have been Grant Morrison and Frank Quiet Lee's new X-Men. Fantastic story that I actually think these books remind me of quite a bit.
For sure, yeah. In that interview with Jonathan Hickman I did at San Diego Comic-Con, he actually, one of the reporters asked him about Grant Morrison and how this was different. And he was saying Morrison had like limitations and I don't.
That sounds very Hickman-y to me.
Yeah. Surprisingly, well, not so surprisingly maybe, so the top two books were X-Men books. Or, you know, ex-mutant related books. And then the third was Amazing Spider-Man. So Marvel took the top three. And get this, those top three, they were not the common $3.99 books. They were higher priced, $5.99 for the X books and $7.99 for the Amazing Spider-Man book.
That's what Absolute Carnage launched out as well. And I'm expecting to see that in the wrap up August.
It's, you know, it's kind of crazy. It's so smart, I guess. I mean, when you have an anniversary issue or a number one, you might as well add a couple pages and jack the price up because it's going to sell more.
Yeah. I mean, Absolute Carnage and this issue of Amazing Spider-Man are 70 pages.
Yeah, so that's huge, yeah.
It feels warranted. I don't know that it feels $8 warranted to me, but an increased price certainly does. Actually, House of X and Powers of 10 were longer as well. Not as long as either of those issues, though.
It does feel, well, with House of X and Powers of 10, it feels like the packaging is of a higher value, like the fact that they have all these graphic design going on into it, and even the paper feel is really nice. Whereas something, not to knock Amazing Spider-Man number 25, but when there are like backup stories thrown in, it's almost like they're buffing it out to reach that 70 pages.
Yeah, I can see that.
Fourth up was Walking Dead number 193, and we all know why that one was so high.
Yeah, so an interesting follow-up on that is that Image had a stronger July than it did last year. That's primarily because of Walking Dead. I know a lot of people are speculating that Image is now really seeking another hit because they're worried that Image is going to kind of drop off the map after Walking Dead. I don't think that's true.
No. God, no.
I don't think that's true at all. But especially when you see that they consistently get the third most sales.
They've got another half of Saga to go.
eBay prices for 193 had approached $40 to $50, when the first issue came out. They've settled back into the teens since a reprint has come out, although professionally graded copies, a CBCS 9.9 has been listed as high as $855.
Damn. Just wait. Yeah. Don't buy it.
Yeah, just wait. Just wait. That'll go down to like 120.
Probably.
Speculating is back big time. Mm-hmm. And I very gleefully and proudly follow that market. I think it's really, really interesting. I don't think that that book is going to stay at $900 for long.
No, probably not. I mean, everyone's just so excited right now.
Yeah.
The next three books were Batman books, which is interesting to me because these books were typically in the top five the previous months. That includes Batman Who Laughs at 7, Batman Curse of the White Knight, number 1, at 6, which is probably way higher than DC was expecting or wanted it to be. They were probably hoping it was more top 3. And then there was Batman Last Night on Earth, number 2, which is part 2 of a 3-part story Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo are doing, which is supposedly their last Batman story. So of course that's high, but not as high again as I thought. But maybe that's because the top 4 were like literally pushing the numbers higher than ever.
Yeah, true.
Shockingly though, can you believe Black Cat number 2 was number 8?
Yeah, and only because the first issue was the best-selling comic of June.
Oh, okay.
That book's doing really, really well.
What? I mean, listen, I reviewed, I don't know if I reviewed number 2.
I told Nathan when we talked about it on that episode, people horny.
J. Scott Campbell is pushing those numbers up. It's got to be. Because he's doing the covers. Number 9 was Immortal Hulk. No surprise there. And then number 10, Batman. Man, Batman just owns the top 10, doesn't he?
Hey, folks, if you're wondering why we talk about these books every week, because everyone is and is buying them.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. Yeah. So that was the top books by units, by the way, not dollars. But it's pretty much the same. Vampirella,
the same order.
Vampirella is on number 10. She's number 10 for top by dollar. And then it's pretty much the same. Besides that, some of the other books flipped.
Yes. I will say something that I think is very interesting that I'm not going to say confidently.
Okay.
I have seen on the, primarily on Twitter, in comics Twitter, comics writing and reviewing and journalism Twitter, that DC is absolutely furious that Immortal Hulk is doing better than Batman.
Huh, that's interesting.
Like, flipping out. Like, potentially the reason that Tom King was asked to step off the book.
Huh. Because so Hulk
I think that's really interesting because they're not similar properties, but
it's someone who's like who's very vain and they're like, Hulk's never been that popular. How dare you?
Right. Big green man.
Everybody knows that's the simple, boring character. Batman's the one. I don't know if we need to go into any other numbers here.
Yeah, no, I think that that's it.
There are graphic novel numbers. If you go to Comicron's website, you can find these numbers. There's some interesting things on there, of course, like a Joker reprint that Brian Azzarello and Lee Bermejo did.
That's the most surprising one for me. Yeah. It sounds like Black Cat is the most surprising for you. That Joker one, I was just like, I guess they reprinted it under Black Label.
Oh, so a lot of people probably thought it was new.
Probably.
Mm, interesting.
Especially because Brian Azzarello and Lee were on Damn.
Oh, maybe they thought there was another genital on a page. Genital.
A genial genital.
Ooh, a genial genital.
But
is that the name of your autobiography?
No. Please, it's a gentleman genital.
Oh, nice. Very nice.
I think people are still hot for those Black Label books, which really surprises me.
Look, that Joker book, I remember buying it when it first came out. I don't know when. It was like 2007 or something. But it's good. It's beautiful. Beautifully drawn.
Yeah.
Or painted.
I'm happy to see them finding a voice and a direction for a Black Label. And we've talked about that in the past. I won't belabor it. I'm happy that DC is finding a collection of books that are being solicited, as well as ones that they're reprinting for Black Label. I'm still surprised that people are – I mean, those books are selling really, really high.
Yeah.
And I didn't expect that given the shakiness with which that label debuted.
It just goes to show you that Jim Lee and Dan Didio were right that people want this adult line. It's just they have to figure out how to make it work.
Yes. Yep.
Well, that's the end of that segment. And then the next segment, top books.
It's over.
For next week, which isn't over because it's not here yet. Okay? It's next week. Jesus Christ.
It's next week. Yeah.
We're going to be talking about our number one book we want to read next week and tell you about probably the week after that, unless it wasn't as good as we thought.
Unless it sucks.
My most anticipated book out next week is Once in Future Number 1 by Kieran Gillen and drawn by Dan Mora. I got to talk to Kieran Gillen at San Diego Comic Con about this book. If you go to aiptcomics.com, I highly recommend you read the interview. He just glows over Mora's art and the pop thriller action that this book is. After speaking to him, I got to look at this book briefly before the interview. And it is a beautiful book. It's basically an archaeologist sort of tale with a woman who is much older. She's like a grandma to a younger man, and they team up to, I don't want to say anything else. There's monsters. It feels very fresh and new. And Gillen even said, it's basically what Marvel's doing with big action, but it's an original tale. It's the same feel, but it's an original tale. Yeah, and
that's cool.
It involves King Arthur and, well, the myth anyway, and he connects the dots there too. So it's really cool. I highly recommend it.
The Stone and the Sword.
Swords in Stones, the sequel too.
Huh, I thought it was the other way around.
It's like a Fast and the Furious thing. What is your most anticipated book out next week?
Two Stone, Two Sword.
There you go. Oh my God! There's two swords.
Let's
that
sell
means
that.
There's
to them.
Two kings.
Yeah. Oh, shit.
How many Merlins are there? Guinevere, where are you?
16. It's exponential.
Oh, no. That's what magic is.
The book that I'm... David Copperfield, you've done it again.
Oh, my God. He made the elephant appear.
My most looking forwardest to book for next week...
That's the name of the segment.
...is Collapser Number 2.
Nice.
Written by Sean Simon and Mikey Way, with art by Elis Kirazis. This is the follow-up to the first issue, Collapser, that is on DC's Young Animal label. It is about a man who has a self-loathing, narcissistic, a bit of an asshole streak, and then gets inflicted. This may be the right word. Inflicted, imbued, beholden. I don't know. He has a black hole in his chest.
Yikes.
And that's not good.
Mm-mm.
But that's a real problem he has to deal with, especially as the second issue, the solicit implies that he destroys Stonehenge with it.
Oh, no.
So that's real bad. It's real not good for him. Mm. But also, I like the way that these writers and this artist are taking things that would just be subtext or kind of weird misplaced dialogue and making it match the story and the art. Really well. There was a lot of really interesting design stuff and elements in the first issue with his narration looking like a black hole. And then he's always wearing dark jackets and he's got shades on and all this stuff. Like, it is so thematically consistent that I'm really, really interested in the story that they have to tell. I'm really excited for it. I think that they definitely have a very well-defined end that they're building to. It was the impression I was left with after the first issue. So I'm looking forward to that quite a bit. I like everything that Young Animal is putting out.
Yeah, it feels fresh. Very, very fresh. Mm-hmm. I haven't picked up Collapser yet, but I need to. Damn it.
It's good. You should check it out. Doom Patrol is also good.
Yes, it is.
Gerard Way's Doom Patrol is fantastic. So I like what they're doing right now.
I hope it gets to continue. Hopefully the sales are up. Guys, go out there and buy Collapser Number 2, damn it.
Yeah, buy it.
Even though we haven't read it yet and we don't know if it's good or not.
Unless it sucks.
Next up, something that definitely doesn't suck is Judging by the Cover Junior, where we talk about our favorite cover art for books coming out next week. Yes, we're talking about next week still. Forrest.
Get over it.
Tell me, was there any covers out there in the world coming out? Not yet out, but they are out on the internet so we can look at them that you liked?
What if I just said no?
I'd be like, huh, he must have had a really down day.
Surprise!
Oh my gosh.
I liked this one, Absolute Carnage Scream.
Are you holding it up for us?
This one, see? I just hit the microphone with it.
If you go to aiptcomics.com and go to this article, you can see the picture. You can also see it on the podcast posting as well.
Yes.
It's very tiny, though. I recommend going to the site to see it.
So this painting is very famous.
Ooh.
It's called Scream.
Ooh.
And what they have done, you are familiar with Scream, the person wailing on the... I think it's a dock.
Yes.
I don't know. I think it's a doc. They have replaced the Wailing figure with the Scream symbiote, which is just fantastic.
Awesome.
It's really, really well done. I don't have much to say about it at all. I think it's kitschy and funny and pretty cool. The Scream symbiote design is pretty great, actually. So.
Yeah, I love the use of yellow. It's really nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just feels so different from Venom and Carnage and Spidey and stuff. It's probably the best out of the Life Foundation symbiotes. And also just like tying the character's name into the title, into the art that well. It's so good.
Nice.
Yeah. And that's by Michael Allred. So thanks, Michael.
Oh, man, I love him so much. I have his classic Mad reprintings, the hardcover. So good.
Mm-hmm.
I recommend that. My favorite cover was Silver Surfer Black number 3 by Trad Moore. If the devil is in the details, then this cover is straight Satan fire.
That's good.
This cover is it actually, when it was released in the solicits a few months back, I made it my Facebook timeline photo, the stretched out one. Mm-hmm. That just shows you how much I liked it.
The long one?
Because I was putting it out there for people who don't even read comics. And they were like, Dave, what's wrong with you? Why are there all these colors? And I was like, back off, man. It's Silver Surfer. And then they thought it was donuts in the picture, and I got upset. Because there are...
I think it looks like space sushi.
Look,
donuts I will hear as well.
They are round, and they have black holes. So I don't know. Maybe they're space sushi donuts. Maybe they're both. Who knows? It's very much like coral, this cover. Yes. There are all these winding streams of what looks like alien goo, in one might say, around Silver Surfer, who has this black arm that's also in color, these weird colors in the blackness as well. It's just, I don't even know how much time it took him to make this. Like, honestly, to draw every little line, every little blobule inside these creatures, it's just fascinating. And it just makes you, it just opens up your imagination to the cosmic side of Marvel, and it's just a reminder of why this series and Silver Surfer in general is just, it's just one of a kind. And I really hope when Marvel Studios makes a movie with Silver Surfer, they look at this cover and think about it.
I like how you employed the secret there.
What secret?
When they make
Silver Surfer. Oh, is that, you mean like the secret, like Oprah's secret?
The book, yeah.
Oh, I don't know anything about that.
Oprah's secret.
It's Gale. Yeah, the book. The answer is Gale. Yeah. Okay, in our next segment, which is a fun segment, I promise you it is fun, fun, fun. We haven't done this in a while. It's called Trash It or Treasure It.
If anything was going to make you think it's fun, it's a person going, no, 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 this will be fun. Trust me, it's fun. It's fun.
This is where I will randomly generate a character, and then Forrest is up. He has to trash or treasure based on a coin flip, okay? Mm-hmm. And... I had the generator up, and now I don't. So I'm going to open it now, and I'm going to randomly generate a character. So are you ready? We're picking Marvel. This was his choice. It wasn't mine. He wants a Marvel character.
Hit me.
All right. I'm picking Ghost Rider.
Oh.
All right. And you have to.
I can go either way with this.
Well, that's not good. I wanted you to have trouble.
I mean that I can really go hard for either one.
All right. You have to treasure Ghost Rider.
Okay.
And wait, hold on. I'm actually going to put a timer on.
All right.
Go.
Most badass design in either of the big two's lines.
Whoa, I don't know about that.
Are you kidding?
I mean, he's...
Which Ghost Rider are we talking about? Are we talking about motorcycle or car?
Motorcycle, of course.
Okay, motorcycle. Awesome. Absolutely
flaming
awesome.
Skull head. Come on.
Those Nicolas Cage movies are so fun.
Yeah. Oh, I love those.
They're so
dumb. I did like those.
Like... Absolutely, the director of Mandy liked those movies so much that he was like, I'm going to do weird art Ghost Rider with Nick Cage.
I can see that.
I love the spirit of vengeance idea. I love this idea that like you can be consumed by anger and hatred and grossness and stuff and utilize it in a way that meets out into a good end for people.
Mm.
I feel the same way about Venom, I guess. It's like a lot of these, a lot of the hosts of the Ghost Rider Hellfire, they see the bad in themselves,
mm-hmm.
and they want better for the world in spite of it. I think that that's a really, really interesting character paradigm.
But isn't he the ruler of hell right now? Doesn't that make him bad?
Well, sometimes. I like that depth and that nuance a lot more than Iron Man or Thor or Captain America, who are good, but very good at one thing. They're kind of one note.
25 seconds.
Ghost Rider has a leather jacket, though.
Oh, that's
true.
And
that's what makes him different than them. Also, his head's on fire, and that's different also. But I really like this angle that it's a person who has a lot of badness and darkness in them.
10 seconds.
But utilizes that to make the world better.
Nice. Yes, he uses evil to do good.
Yeah.
Nice. I would agree with that. I feel like the character is owed maybe a better long arc, sort of like how Immortal Hulk is sort of revolutionizing the character.
I would love to see like a capsule story for the character, yeah.
Capsule story, that's an interesting term. I've never heard that. I like it.
I made it up just now.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. It sounds like something that, you know, Einstein came up with even.
Yeah, I think Einstein came up with Ghost Rider.
If we slap a quote on this podcast, like the podcast poster, it'll say, you know, something.
That's something Einstein came up with.
Forrest said something that Einstein came up with. David Brooke. Okay, in our last segment, Off Topic Top Shelf, we're going to talk about something not comic related because I'm sure you're sick of it by now.
Shut up about the comics.
And Forrest is up to tell us about something he's getting into right now that he likes lots and lots that's not comic related. Go ahead, Forrest. That was my Einstein voice.
Thanks. That was good. It sounded just like
him. E=mc². Go ahead.
My pick is Dragon Quest, the video game series Dragon Quest.
Ooh.
I am a big, big fan of RPGs and particularly JRPGs. I like Final Fantasy a lot. I like all the Elder Scrolls and Skyrim and Fallout and all that stuff. I like Suikoden. I like all those things. I think that Dragon Quest is the pinnacle of that experiment or aesthetic. It's just so warm and inviting. All of the character design is done by Akira Toriyama, the creator of Dragon Ball Z.
Ooh.
So that aesthetic obviously feels really nostalgic, I think, to people in our age bracket. And I think it's also good. And for lack of a better word, I just find that aesthetic so good and warming and interesting. I like the happiness and the general positivity of it, that the main logo or icon is a little slime smiling. The games are also fantastic. I've been playing Dragon Quest XI on my PS4 while my fiance plays Dragon Quest Builders on her Switch. And the way that they balance humor and serious topics and, you know, really, really big cosmic storytelling, like the end of the universe is coming based on some sort of celestial deity that wants to destroy all life, balanced out with like this guy's smiley.
Uh-huh.
You know, like I think it's really well done. I like the aesthetic of it a lot. I really, really appreciate the historical impact that it has. I don't think Pokemon, Final Fantasy, Fire Emblem, any of those things would exist without Dragon Quest. And it's so, so fascinating to me how someone can play a Dragon Quest game and feel like they're home, even if it's their first one.
Mm, nice atmosphere and tone.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. It just makes me feel good.
It's funny that you say it makes you feel good, because last week when I picked The Boys, you were saying, I don't know if you said this off air or not. I think you said it on air. Like, you just don't want something that is just negative and, like, reiterating how corporations are destroying everything and, like,
yeah,
you don't need any more of that in your life.
I think that this is kind of the perfect antithesis to that.
It's like your pick of Dragon Quest is a middle finger to my last week pick.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh. No, I'm talking around it because it's very hard for me to capitalize on the way that they make me feel. Mm-hmm. Playing them,
yeah.
Or even just looking at the art and the merchandise and stuff.
Is it nostalgia?
It is.
Dan Didio was wrong.
It's such an internal feeling. It's very hard for me to express, admittedly. But I find that everyone that likes Dragon Quest feels that same way.
Mm.
So I think that there's some sort of inherent goodness or will or creativeness to it that excites people in like a childhood endearment kind of way.
Nice.
And I just, it's great. It's good.
I need a Dragon Quest in my life. Where can I find the...
You need a Dragon Quest.
I need to find this dame. Lock her down.
If you like Minecraft, you should start with Dragon Quest Builders 2. If you like Final Fantasy, you should start with Dragon Quest 11.
If I don't like any of those things, I have a black heart and I will die sad.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's right.
Well, that's the end of our show. Thank you for listening if you've made it this far. If you've liked the show, please like it and subscribe and even review on Apple if you feel like you have the words to say how joyous this show is.
And you know what? I'm going to own up to it. You can put make me feel good in the comments because that's about how well I describe why I like Dragon Quest.
There you go. If you liked the show as much as Forrest likes Dragon Quest, then you have to give it a 5 out of 5.
You have to.
Well, thanks for listening.
Thanks. See ya.
Bye.